Okay, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and I will asterisk the introduction by saying this is one of those texts that's kind of a softball pitch, right? And here's what I mean by that. If you've ever played softball, like the goal in softball is not to strike out the batter, okay? The goal in softball is to field out the batter. And so a softball pitch is, it's underhand, and I know some of you ladies are like, no, I do fast pitch. All right, so fast pitch is a different story. Regular softball, it's kind of a lob, and you have like basically two opportunities. The batter is going to clobber the ball, right? And then you have to field them to get them out, or everybody's going to get a good laugh because they're going to whiff and look so embarrassed as they do it, right? So this text this morning, it's kind of like that. Our opportunity is to either clobber it or just really whiff and miss it. And I've been around conferences and things where pastors have been tasked with talking about the love of God. It's kind of a softball because it's all over the Bible, right? There, you could go for hours and hours and just keep talking about the love of God. And I've been there where it's been whiffed, right? I went to one conference where the pastor that was speaking was, he was a scholar that I'm thoroughly impressed with. And what he kept talking about in love was, he kept using the term, the intra-Trinitarian love of God, right? He lost me at that point. And so my hope is to not whiff and lose you. My hope is to encourage you in the Spirit. And so we're gonna be talking about God's love this morning, right? And here's the way I want to frame it up. And I'm using that sort of in pun language because one of the things I love home improvement. Right? Do I have any brothers and sisters that love home improvement? Yes, I love it. I delight in it. It started at a very young age when my father decided that our kitchen wasn't large enough and the way that the laundry room fit, he needed to blow out some walls and construct everything. And as a little tyke, man, I was following him around. And from early age, I was like, I want to do that. I want to tear apart my house and rebuild a structure around it. And so every house that I've owned has needed some pretty significant remodeling, right? The first house I owned, it was my wife and I, we bought a small house on a big plot of land. And when we found the news that our son Ashton was going to be born, we had to gut a room, pull the ceiling out, the walls out, rebuild around the back of the fireplace to make it safe so that his little room didn't burn down if we started a fire in the fireplace, because you usually don't want to do that, right? And so that we had to do that. In our last house in Asheville, I was very handy in building a 200-square-foot addition, built a new living room, put a wood stove in, because every house needs to have a fireplace, right? Because when the power goes out, like, you still need to stay warm. So did that, and then the house that we're in now, I've cut holes in the wall, I've replaced all the windows, I've reglazed some things, I've redone the kitchen, I'm getting ready to gut a bathroom, and I love it, right? I'm always looking for a project to get my hands dirty with. And I'm in a weird stage right now because I've loaned like a lot of my tools out and they've been away from me for several weeks, maybe even 2 months now. And I feel like a part of me is just kind of, I loaned it out to a very trustworthy, reliable family that I love very much. You don't maybe know them, maybe you do. But I feel like a part of me is just kind of, it's just not there, right? Tools are, I love it. I love going to Home Depot. I love walking through and looking at tools and materials and starting thinking about what can I create with that? What can I improve? What can I make more beautiful? And my kids don't get it. And so my boys are starting to get it a little bit, and I hope they catch the bug. But if they don't, I'm going to be okay with that, I think. Kai likes to help me with things. He helped me build a deck in the backyard, but my daughter is not interested at all. And so when I go to Home Depot, she usually brings a friend along. And then when her friend comes with me, we were just at Home Depot the other day, and I'm walking through, and I'm looking, I'm supposed to be there to get a piece of pipe for plumbing, and I don't ever just go get what I need. Like, I'm looking around because I love being in there. And my daughter and her friend are singing at the top of their lungs all of the songs to Frozen, right? And so they're entertaining all the other poor people that have been dragged into Home Depot but don't want to be there. And so it just made it a joyful event for everybody that was in the store, right? The entourage of singing Frozen songs. But not only that, not only do I love home improvement, like not only do I love getting my hands dirty with it, I love watching other people do it. And so one of my guilty pleasures in life is the DIY network. Do you guys have DIY network? I love it. There's this one show in particular I've been able to rope my wife into watching with me, and she likes a lot of the design shows as well. She doesn't like all the improvement shows, like the house flipping things, but she likes this one particular show that we watched together. It's called Renovation Realities. Have any of you seen Renovation Realities? Here's basically the plot. They get somebody who's got some tools who thinks he knows what he's doing with those tools to tear apart his kitchen or some structure in his house, and his poor wife is there to help him do what he has no business doing to begin with, right? And so all the time, it's always the guy having the lady hold up the beam while he's standing there with a drill driver, right? And she's like, I'm going to drop it, and the house is going to fall. And he's got his drill driver like, just tough it out. Hold it there for a second. And then they bicker, and that's what makes good TV, right? And we laugh about it because here's what it teaches about how we operate as people. And then Paul is going to draw a very similar parallel when it comes to our spiritual lives. What it tells us is that we think that when we have the right tool, we can do anything, right? You give a man a sledgehammer, he thinks he's suddenly an architect and should be knocking walls down in his home, right? He shouldn't. He's got a tool, he needs to learn how to use it. But we think that just because we have tools, we can do with them what we want. And Paul says, yeah, your spiritual life, it's very similar to that. Just because you have gifts doesn't mean you know how to use them. And that's where Paul's going to go with us in 1 Corinthians 13 this morning. He's going to tell us, you might have gifts. You might be able to do amazing gifts. It doesn't mean you necessarily know how to use them. And sometimes when you use your gifts in unresourceful ways, you're going to do more harm than you do good. So that kind of lays the foundation of where we're going. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 1. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. So here's what Paul is doing. He's talking about spiritual gifts. He's not talking about what we're, you know, when we get into the love text, he's not talking about marriage. And I know you don't even have to be a Christian to be familiar with the text that we're about to read. If you've been to a wedding, you've probably heard somebody at some point quote 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter. If you look at the context, this is not talking about marriage, right? Now, it can apply to a marriage, but specifically what Paul is talking about here is how do we get along in the body and how do we use our gifts to encourage one another? And he starts it off by using these hyperbolic statements, these exaggerated statements that say, like, even if you can, and he uses some grandiose extreme to illustrate a point. And he's saying, if you use a gift, you might be as gifted as anybody in the world, but if you don't have love, you're going to be destructive. You're going to be destructive with that gift. And so the first hyperbole he uses is the use of tongues, right? Lowest gift, we looked at this last week. We'll look at it again. We'll explore tongues more in depth. But here's what he's saying. He's saying, if you speak with the tongues of men and angels, right? If the utterances, if the declarations that you're making are impressing angelic beings, but you don't have love, then you're just making noise. You're just making noise. Now, that should immediately confront us and cause us to pause and say, okay, the mark of my spiritual maturity is not how well I speak in tongues. Now, some people want to make an argument. Okay, are there tongues of angels? Is this what's happening in tongues language? Maybe, maybe not. I think Paul is just trying to make an exaggerated point, right? If you're good enough with your tongue, if that's the gift that you have to speak with the languages of men or even the language of angels, no matter how gifted you might feel you are with that particular thing, if you don't have love, you're just making noise. And here's my concern. In the church, we're making a lot of noise, aren't we? Especially as our culture seems to not have much respect for the things that we're saying anymore. What we're doing often is we're saying it louder. And I think in a lot of ways, it's not being said in love. And so we're just making noise. Here's what Paul doesn't say. Paul doesn't say, if you speak with tongues without love, well, then don't do that anymore. He doesn't make little of the gift. What he says is you're becoming self-destructive. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but I don't have love, I am a noisy gong. I'm just making noise, and most people want to avoid the noise that I'm making. And it affects you. And so no matter how gifted you are, that is not a mark of your maturity in Jesus. Some people have gifts. That doesn't mean they know how to use them. And Paul is saying we need to understand how to use them. Second thing he says is, if I have prophetic gifts and understand, and again, he's using hyperbole here, all mysteries, all knowledge. Now, he's going to tell us next week in 1 Corinthians 13, the latter half of the chapter, nobody knows all mysteries and has all knowledge, right? He's going to say, we prophesy in part, we know in part. Nobody has that. But if you do, right, if you have the gift of understanding all mysteries, all knowledge, which you don't, but even if you did and you don't have love, you're still nothing. You're still nothing. And he goes on, last point he makes, if I give away my possessions and I even give away my body to be burned, right? That's an interesting way of putting it. What he's saying here is, if I feed away all of my possessions, if I'm careful with how I give them away so that it does the most to make me look like I'm good at giving things away, right? I feed them all away, but I don't do it in love, then again, I gain nothing. And so what he's contrasting here is, when you do what you do to draw attention to you, you're going to be self-destructive. And you're probably going to hurt others along the way, right? You're the guy that's fixing his house, and you're saying, I really have no right to change this beam out. My whole house could come down. I'm going to make my wife hold the weight of it. I've got my drill driver. I'm not really sure what I'm doing, but here we go. And he's saying, even if you have the most fantastic drill driver in the world, if you do something without love behind it, people are going to get hurt, and you are going to self-destruct. So gifting is not a mark of spiritual maturity, right? And so this should really confront us, because most of us, we think that spirit gifts attest to how close we are to God. The more I speak in tongues, well, I must be much more mature. I must be closer to God than people that are around me. If I understand the intricacies of how God works in his kingdom more than people that are around me, well, then I must be closer to God than the people that are around me. And Paul said, no, your spirit gifts declare nothing about your maturity. One can be thoroughly gifted, but lack love and self-destruct. I think we saw this past week when Philip Seymour Hoffman, who was incredibly gifted, perhaps one of the greatest actors of our day, didn't have love in his soul and overdosed and destroyed himself. Incredibly gifted. Right? And if gifting were a sense of spiritual maturity or arriving or being closer to anybody, then the people with the most gifts would never self-destruct, but we never see that, do we? Paul's saying, don't let that be a measure of how mature you are. Your spiritual gifts don't attest to that. In fact, God's not after your accomplishments. He's after your heart. God's after your heart. Let me illustrate it this way. I think this will help make sense of what Paul is talking about. We have four kids. Three of them understand obedience and disobedience. My youngest son, Bracken, who's 18 months, he pretty much only understands disobedience, right? The other day, he got out of the tub. He's buck naked. His hair's wet. And I'm telling him, hey, come here. I need to get you dressed. He hears come here. And then what he decides to do with come here is giggle and laugh and run the other direction, right? He only understands disobedience. So my other kids, they know the difference. And so when I say something like, hey, I want you to clean up your room, there's a couple of different ways that they can respond to that, right? The first way is they can get upset. They can dig their heels in. They can stick their chest out. They can defy. And they can spout off, no, right? That's defiance. That's defiance. And my children are not allowed to defy mom and daddy. There's discipline when it comes to defiance. But then there's another way where they actually look like they're obeying, but they're not obeying. And this is when I say, hey, I need you to go clean up your room. And while they're going up the stairs, they're doing what I'm telling them to do. Their arms are crossed. Their lip is pouty. They're stomping on every step. They go up and they do what they're told to do, but they do it with a disobedient spirit. And so there's obedience and there's disobedience and defiance that's coming out of their heart. And let me ask you, as a good dad, is that what I want? Do I want them to just obey? I don't want them to just obey. The Father doesn't want us to just obey. He wants us to do it in a way that expresses love. And so they might go up and they might very skillfully put everything that they own in the place where it belongs, but it hasn't accomplished anything. It doesn't foster love in our relationship. And Paul's saying it's gifts are kind of like that. God's not after us just doing what he says we're supposed to do. He's after our hearts. He wants loving relationship. And so what I want my kids to do, and you know, it takes a supernatural miracle of grace for this to happen. When I say, hey, I need you to go up and clean your room, I want them to say, okay, Daddy, and joyfully, because they love the relationship that we have, go upstairs and put the things away, right? Because at the end of the day, I do want a clean room, but at the end of the day, that's not the thing that matters. I want good relationship with my kids. And God's the same way. He's not at all interested in just what you can accomplish. He's interested in good relationship with his kids. And so we get caught up in the, but I did the gifts. I spoke with the tongue of men of angels. And God said, yeah, but you didn't have love. Yeah, you did what you were told, but you did it with the wrong spirit. That's not what I'm after. I'm after your heart. And so I want us to stop and ask, just as a community and even as individuals, in what ways do we exercise gifts but lack love? And I'll give you kind of a primer on how to think about this, because I think as a church community, you can see it kind of collectively so that maybe you can see it in your own heart. But what is Missio Dei known for? What are we known for? I'll tell you what, in times past, like I've kind of wanted to be known for, and these are things that we do, and I think they're gifts. But I think one of the things that we're known for theological precision, right? We like to get it right. We don't want to mess around. I mean, we want to be able to articulate, here is clearly what God is saying in this text. Here's what he's not saying, and that's a good thing. But at the end of the day, if we have all theological precision and we don't have love, we're nothing, we're not accomplishing anything, we're not gaining anything. We're going to become empty, and we'll have our theology right, and we'll be alone, right? We're like the child that does what he's told, but does it with a pouty disposition and anger and really a defiant spirit and not done out of love. What else? I mean, how much? We can go beyond this. I mean, some of us, I've seen this come out this week. For those of you that were kind of paying attention, you recognize Northern Kentucky, there was a debate between Ken Ham and Bill Nye the Science Guy, right? And here's the thing. I was not convinced that this was going to accomplish like major worldview shifts. I think opportunities may have been missed on both sides to really say where they were coming from. But here's what grieved me in the fallout of this debate. It wasn't so much if Christian people felt like Bill Nye did a better job of arguing his points. I don't know if he did or if he didn't, and really, it's kind of beside the point. What troubled me was how many people that confessed Jesus that would call Ken Ham a brother because of his confession of faith tried to distance themselves from him and make him sound like a fool and a buffoon and somebody that doesn't represent me well and just said, ew, I don't want to be associated with that man. And here's the problem with that. What it says is that we think we can convince the world that we're disciples of Jesus if we have the right intellectual answers and it's spoken to them in a way that they can receive, which is not what Jesus said. Jesus said, people are going to know that you're my disciples when you love one another. And I would love to see somebody come out and say, hey, you know what? I don't necessarily agree with anything that Ken Ham presented, but you know what? He loves God and people enough to get up there and have the stones to make a stand. And so he got up there and he did something that most of us are kind of a little bit afraid to do, which is take on a public personality, something we're radically divided about, and then talk about it in a respectful way. But where was that? Where was the, I love this brother even if I disagree with him? See, it grieves me that when we as the church start to do that, like we're just cannibalizing spiritually one another. And all in this effort to kind of stand out, make a name for ourselves, I'm not like that guy, that's not love. And no matter how articulate, no matter how genius you are, no matter how many gifts you can spout out, if you're operating without love, it's nothing. It's nothing. and your ability to articulate your stance on creation or evolution has no bearing on your spiritual maturity. Love does. Love does. So think about it. What are we known for? In the Christian world, I think as people are looking in, if you ask them honestly, what are we like? I think we come across as if God approves only of us. How loving is that? He doesn't approve of any of you, only us. We love you, but you need to become one of us to be approved. We come across as if our ears, our minds, and our hearts are closed to anyone who might not agree with us on every point. That's not loving. We come across as though we are the only ones who know how to behave ethically. And so people need to come to us to figure out how to carry themselves morally. And then people are on the outside are looking in, they're saying, but you're not much more moral than I am, and maybe even less than some of the friends that I keep. We come across as if we are disinterested in people for anything other than getting them to agree with a few of our supernatural beliefs. And here's the thing, our supernatural beliefs, and I hold them, I think they're wonderful, they don't make rational sense, right? They don't at all. And so you're never going to sound intelligent to an unbeliever because it's not a matter of intellect, of belief and unbelief. It's a matter of the heart. It's a matter of love. Think about our faith for just a moment, okay? And tell me how intellectual this sounds. We believe that there is God whom none of us today have seen face to face. Right? We believe that. We confess that. The Bible even declares that there is God that you love that you haven't seen face to face, that it takes faith to see God. Now, not only do we believe that, but we believe in ancient times, there was a woman who was a virgin who conceived a baby, right? How many of you have I lost on the intellectual spectrum there, right? I mean, that doesn't make intellectual sense. Yeah, we believe that there was a girl who was pregnant, but it wasn't through natural means. She had a miracle baby. And the baby that she was having was a God-man baby, right? And then she delivers the God-man baby. So baby God is walking around. That's crazy, isn't it? I mean, that sounds utterly insane, but that's what we believe. And so your efforts to try to make it sound reasonable and rational, they will probably fall on deaf ears. That's where they're going to fall. And Jesus says, yeah, don't try to sound intellectual. I'm not here to build up your pride or your arrogance. I'm here to cause you to love people. And so more than anything, I want us to consider the ways in which we might exercise gifts. We might have theological precision, right? We might have intellectual answers, but we're doing it in a way that isn't loving. Because if we do that, we self-destruct, and I think we're all aware of it. We all recognize the realities of being gifted without being loving. We've all recognized that there are times in our life where we've spoken, and we've spoken truth, and it's fallen on deaf ears because our desire was to be right instead of to be loving. And so you might be right, but because you're not loving, it's noise that people want to avoid. God is after a heart, and he's after a heart that loves. This is why Jesus is indispensable. This is why in the Christian faith we want Jesus, because Jesus is God's fullest expression and fullest declaration of the love of God. You want to know what God's love is like? You look at Jesus. And I find it amazing that what Paul is going to do next is he's going to talk about love, right? He doesn't just say, if you don't have love, you're nothing. He's going to say, oh, and here's what love should look like. And the way he describes it as a person. He gives it personal attributes. Love is like this. And that makes sense to us because we know love as a person. We know Jesus. And so you could really easily substitute the word love for the name Jesus in everything that Paul is about to explain. He's going to say Jesus is patient and kind. Jesus is not does not envy or boast. That's Jesus. And so we need him. He is indispensable. Right? Because the innocent one, the loving one, took on the betrayal and the abandonment of us who are guilty and who are hateful. And he removed it from us. So the life he pours into us is one of hope and of life, of welcome, of blessing. That's the way that we're supposed to operate in these gifts. And so at the end of the day, here's what Paul is telling us. This is the piece I want us to kind of reform our minds around. Spirit gifts are empowerments to express love. They're opportunities for you to say, I love you. If your gift is tongues, then you are, in other languages, you're going to say, I love you. If your gift is healing, it's a way that you're going to say, here's how I love you with my hands. If your gift is telling the truth, you're going to be able to do it in a way that it can be received, where people feel like they're being loved. The spirit gifts are nothing more than expressions of love. That's what Paul is trying to get across. And so that we don't miss it, he gives us a description, and here's what it's like. And I love the way he describes it. Like I said, he makes it personal. But he kind of challenges our mindset on what love is and what love isn't. Now, sometimes we get caught up in when trying to describe something. We're good at deconstructing, but not great at constructing in its place. And here's what I mean by that. When people ask you about your church or your relationship with God, specifically your church, how do you answer them, right? For a lot of us, like, you start to explain, tell me about your church. Okay, well, you know, you don't have to wear a suit to come to my church. Okay, that's what you're not. You can wear a suit, right? We want to say that from the stage. If you're fond of wearing suits, wear a suit. Come on in. We'll love you anyway, all right? But we don't have a choir. We don't have a stuffy organ. Okay, I recognize that's what you don't have. You don't have suits. You don't have organs. Okay, what do you have? Well, we don't have stuffy music. And okay, we don't have a boring pastor. He may not teach very accurately, but hey, he's not boring, right? Some of you are like, yeah, he is boring. But you hear what I'm saying? Like, some of us, we're reacting to so much that we don't know when to turn it off. And there is a huge difference between thinking critically and being critical. And we're just critical, right? And so we're picking apart everything that's going on. And here's what Paul is going to do. He's going to give us a list. And he's going to say, here's what love is like, and here's what it's not like. Sometimes it's good to distinguish what you are by saying, and here's what we're not. But when it's always here's what we're not, and it's never what we are, we don't get a clear picture. So Paul wants to give us that list. He's going to give us both things. He's going to give us two positive things up front. Then he's going to give us a list of eight things that love is not. And then he's going to back it up with five things that love is. So eight things that it's not, seven things that it is in total. But the way he describes it, he gives it a person, and then he describes it as actions. And so here's the last thing I'm going to mention about love before we start picking apart what he says it is or how he describes it. Love is both affection and action. It's affection and action. In our culture, we get caught up in talking about love in ways of it's some power out there that sort of falls on us, right? The proverbial Cupid, he shoots you with his arrow. You didn't ask for it, but all of a sudden, you've fallen in love. And eventually, the poison from the arrow dies out. You fall out of love. That's not biblical love, right? That's not religious affection. Now, it is that. There are feelings that come about with it, right? Some of the things that he's going to describe are descriptions of how we should feel. And so love is an emotion. Let's not overreact so much and say, no, love is a choice and that's all it is. No, here's what it is. Love is an action of affection. It's your feelings being played out. It's this combination of both your emotions and your will working together. So love isn't something you fall into. It's something you decide to walk in. That's why you're commanded to love. You're commanded to do that. Right? And so here's what he says it is. Let's look at these. First things, love is, and like I said, you could say Jesus is. Love is patient and kind. What does patient mean? It means large or grand with suffering. And so the biblical expectation is suffering is going to come your way. And what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to be great with it. You're supposed to be large with it. You're supposed to not retaliate as soon as suffering comes. That's what it means to be patient, right? Love is patient. It waits. Love waits. Have you ever read the Old Testament story about Jacob when he wanted to get married? He meets this girl. He falls in love with her, but then he has to act on it. And so what does he do? He says to her father, Laban, I would like to marry your daughter. And Laban says, okay, you're going to have to wait 7 years and work for me. And Jacob's like, okay, why? Because love is patient. 7 years go by, they have a wedding ceremony, somehow he gets duped, and he marries the wrong woman, right? I don't know how that happens, okay? Maybe it's because their culture was just radically different. But at some point, like if I had formed a relationship with my now wife and like I'm working and it's 7 years and I'm really committed and I'm waiting and I'm patient and we get to the wedding night and I'm going through the vows and I don't somehow figure out this isn't the one I think it is, like I hope I'd say something before everything gets consummated. He waits until the wedding is consummated and then he's like, oh, I've been duped. This isn't the woman I thought I was going to marry and I still want to marry her, right? And so he says to Laban, I would still like to marry the girl that I came for. Laban says, well, you can't marry her. She's not the firstborn. But you can marry her now. So 7 more years. What does he do? He waits. He works 7 more years until he marries her. Now, the moral of the story is not that you shouldn't have multiple wives, although you shouldn't, right? Jesus says, a man shall leave his father and mother, and those two shall become one flesh, not those three, not those four. So the vision of marriage in the Bible is definitely a man and a woman coming together, right? Not plural marriage, none of that thing. But the point is, wait. Love waits. Love is patient. Love is also kind. Love is kind. It not only waits, but it actually, it's quick to pay back with goodness when it does suffer. That's what kindness is. You're suffering, you're not retaliating with evil, you're retaliating with goodness. I will speak good words to you. I will guard my heart so that it doesn't think evil of you. I will be kind. I will express kindness. Love does that. It doesn't pay back what we've received with injury with more. It expresses goodness and kindness back. And then he goes through a list of things that love doesn't do. First thing, love doesn't envy. What does that mean? It means it doesn't envy, right? It doesn't want what it doesn't have. This is why one of the admonitions that we make to men and women who are wanting to get married, we tell them what you don't have that you think you desire that's going to be completed in another human being is not going to be completed. If you think that another human is going to fill up something that you don't have, that's not love, that's envy, right? Love does not want what it doesn't have. Marital love says, I'm going to commit to this person because I think God is doing something in his or her life that I'm going to be able to be a part of blessing and encouraging. That's what love does. It doesn't say, I have a need, this person meets my need, therefore we'll get married and now my needs will be met. And for those of you that walk into marriage thinking that that's what love is, day 2, 3, 4, I don't know when, but at some point you're going to recognize, wait, this person isn't fulfilling the need that I thought I had. I'm actually left a little emptier because I thought this person would fill my need, and he or she isn't, and now I'm self-destructing because it's not love, right? Love gives. Love serves. It doesn't envy. It doesn't see people as opportunities to meet your own needs. That's envy. That's not love. He goes on, love does not boast. What does that mean? It means you don't boast, right? It means you don't exaggerate who you are or what you've done to extol yourself. It's interesting. You start to see the pattern. Paul is talking about the gifts when they're used, if I speak with the tongues of angels, of men and of angels. But I don't have love because it's all about me. I am a noisy gong. My noise is offensive to people. He goes, if the gifts are all about making much of me, meeting my needs, helping me to get what I don't have, helping me to boast in what I've accomplished, then that is not accomplishing anything. That's not a spirit gift, or at least it's not being operated in correctly. You will self-destruct if it's focused on you. Love is not arrogant. It's not swelled up. It's not puffed up. It doesn't walk with swagger, right? Love doesn't do that. Love is humble. Love is not rude. Now, this is a tough one. What it means by rude is that it's not defiant. It doesn't behave improperly toward others. It doesn't impose itself on other people. The logical conclusion of rudeness is physical rape. And the Bible says, no, that's not love. When you impose yourself on people, that's rude. That's not love. And many of us, when it comes to operating in our gifts, we've got a gift, we feel like we have to share it, and we start to impose ourselves on other people. And we start to critique, right? Well, you're not doing this way. This is the need I have. This is the opportunity I want to see so I can express my goodness and my greatness. Now, that's not love, that's rudeness. You're violating other people. Love is not like that. It does not impose itself. It's not pushy. Love does not insist on its own way, right? It's not self-seeking. Love does not say, well, I like this particular brand of music, and you guys only play this, and if you were a godly church, you would do it this way. Now, that's self-seeking. That's not loving. Love doesn't seek its own way or insist on its own way. Love is not irritable or resentful. These are good. These ones hit me pretty hard. They hit me pretty personally. That irritable part, that means sharp and quick with anger, like you're lying in wait for somebody to mess up. Here's something that I don't know if I'm proud of it or not, but it's just kind of, I think it illustrates what irritableness is, and it's me, with my kids in particular sometimes. My kids have this thing with when they stay up too late, the next day can be a nightmare for all of us, right? They're tired, they're cranky, they don't have patience, right? And so I get a little bit like anxious around bedtime. And when I put them to bed, I want them to go to sleep, especially as it gets later. And so there have been nights, even recently, where I've put the kids to bed and I know they need to go to sleep and I've explained it to them and I'm expecting good, obedient, godly children, right? And so I put them to, and I'll go downstairs and I'll wait and I'll listen at the bottom of the stairs. And I'm just waiting for that first conversation to start back up after I've asked them, please be quiet, please go to sleep, lights out, all that kind of thing, right? That's irritable. When you're sort of just waiting for somebody to mess up so that you can correct it quickly. Now, I might have a reasonable excuse, right? It might be done out of love because I need them to quiet down so that they can go to sleep, so that we can all be happy and harmonious. But you can see, like, we sometimes do it not because it's for the betterment of other people, but because we're just easily bothered. We're just irritable. And so we're watching, and we're just waiting. We're ready to pounce. As soon as somebody messes up, we're all over it. That's being irritable. Next one, resentful. Here's what this means. It means you don't keep score. Man, this is one of the biggest things that we need to learn, particularly in relationships. How many relationships get devastated because we keep score? How many friendships are broken because you start to count the number of times that you've called or texted versus the number of times that the person that you're calling or texting has called or texted you, and it's not enough, and you're keeping score, and you're resentful? How many marriages fall apart because of how much one spouse does over the other, and you're keeping score? Love doesn't keep score. Love doesn't say, hey, I unloaded the dishwasher twice for you last week, and all you've done for me is. That's not love. That's resentment, right? It's keeping score, and love doesn't do that. He says love does not rejoice at wrongdoing. Here's what this is. This is trying to distinguish yourself based on what other people are doing wrong. And this is why what I saw in the fallout of this week's debate grieved me so much. It was people saying, well, I stand apart from this person because he did it wrong, right? Rejoicing at wrongdoing, rejoicing when other people don't do it like you because you're seeking to stand out. Love does the opposite, and he starts getting positive with love again. It doesn't rejoice with wrongdoing. It rejoices with truth. And so rather than saying, here's why I stand out, here's why we don't agree, it says, yeah, we might have pretty radical disagreements on most things in life, but here's where we do agree, right? We build bridges that we can walk across and that we can lock arms together with. That's what love does. Love rejoices when we line up on things that are true. That's what love does. That's what Jesus does. That's when he comes alongside of us and he says, yeah, what you're doing, I gave you the gift to do that, but let's celebrate it, right? That's love. It goes on. It bears all things, right? It puts up with people. It carries things. It has strong shoulders to come alongside of one another and says, let me carry this with you. Jesus does that for our sin. He does that with our heart. He does that with our cares. He does that with our concerns. I love the way that the community is coming together around the Harkins family, right? Love brews coffee in our community and says we're going to give the proceeds to a family that needs our help. That's what love does. It bears burdens with one another. They've got a financial burden. We're going to try to help them make it. And the beauty is we're going to get good coffee along the way, and we're actually going to help some other people make a living at it. That's love. It bears all things. What else does it do? It believes all things and hopes all things. That means this. It's going to trust people. Love trusts. Love doesn't come in and say, yeah, I'm not sure I really can trust you. Skepticism is not a loving thing. And here's what I'm saying. I'm not saying we don't need to think critically, but we don't need to become critical and doubt everything that people are doing around us. Instead of disbelieving, it hopes, it looks with confidence, it believes the best in people. How many people in your life, when they say something, you're not sure if you can trust it or rely on it? You're not sure that you believe it, and you certainly don't hope for them to do better. Love does. Love says, I know you've failed me X amount of times, but I'm not going to pay back your failure with arrogance. I'm not going to pay back your failure with disbelief. I'm going to believe you. I'm going to trust you. I'm going to hope that God does something in your life. You might have to say something about it, right? You might have to say, hey, I'm disappointed. I'm struggling for this. I'm not going to be foolish or unwise, but hey, I want to see this in you, instead of writing them off as hopeless and a waste of time, right? And then finally, love endures all things. It remains over the long term. It isn't swayed away from people. It doesn't give up. Love doesn't give up. It keeps going. This is what God wants his people to experience. And as we operate in the gifts, it should nourish that kind of spirit, that kind of heart out of us. Jesus removes the hatefulness and he puts in its place love. And because of Jesus, we get to walk this out. And so I know this is sort of conceptual. Let me give you three things that I think might be practical, that as you start to walk out and you start to think about things, put them in these categories of how you'll walk in love. Because spirit gifts, at the end of the day, they're empowerments to love. And so how are you using them? How are you keeping your spirit gifts in perspective so that they don't come tumbling down on you or people around you? Number one, we need to ask God to develop in us a sense of character of love over competency in gifts, right? Ask for God not to give you greater ability to accomplish things, but greater capacity to love people. Character over competency is always best. And so this is the way this gets played out in our world, like in our ministry. A lot of men, they think that they have a calling to ministry, and so what they do is they go on to seminary. I'm not down on seminary. I went to seminary. I love it. I thought it was a great opportunity. But I meet a lot of men in seminary who are very gifted intellectually, but don't have a lot of love, and they don't have a lot of compassion. They don't have a lot of character, and maybe they shouldn't be doing ministry. I would rather have a guy that isn't educated, because we can always fill your mind with ideas and content, but has character and has specifically the character of love. Somebody who might mess up a little bit, who's quick to repent, who's quick to say, you know what? I was wrong about this. I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? How can I lead you more to Jesus? Well, so when I hear about things like failures in the church, what I don't want to do is punish people. We want to express love and grace and gratitude and say, yeah, you messed up. But when you're quick to repent, you're the kind of person that we want others to emulate, right? Not the ones that have it all together, not the ones that know all the answers, but the people that when they fail, they run to Jesus. That's a good example. That takes character. People that have it all together, they have competency, but competency without character, that can destroy souls. Without love, it's nothing. We want love. We want to be known for love. And so we're going to ask God to change our character to one of love instead of just increasing our competency. Now, at the end of the day, we want both, right? But character over competency. Character over competency. So we're going to let Jesus put to death our envy. We're going to let Jesus put to death our boasting, our arrogance, our rudeness, our selfishness, our irritableness, our resentment, our rejoicing at wrongdoing. And we're going to ask him in his spirit to give us life to patience, to kindness, to rejoicing with the truth, to bearing, believing, hoping, and enduring all things for the sake of the good of others. And when we operate in those gifts, we're going to make much of God. We're going to love God. We're going to love his people. So character over competency. Second thing, ask God to allow us to make a difference over making a point. We want to make a difference over making a point. We want to be a welcome place for people who radically disagree with us, whether we're right or whether we're wrong. Too often, we're just interested in having people agree with us over relatively superficial things, secondary matters, that at the end of the day, they don't change people's lives. We want to create that kind of welcoming environment where it doesn't matter where you're coming from. You're going to be received in here. We're going to say, I'm so glad to see you. I want to build you up. I want to pray for you. I want to learn from you. We want a welcoming spirit, a place where we're interested in making a difference, not just in the lives of those who come, but in our own lives, rather than standing like we've figured this out and we've got it right. And so think about how that plays out in your personal relationships. When's the last argument that you were engaged with where you finally realized, ugh, I'm so busy trying to make a point instead of trying to make a difference? And sometimes you make a bigger point and difference when you shut your mouth, right? Some of you are like, yeah, you can get off the stage now. Got one more point and I will. One more point and I will. Seek to build up rather than stand out. In our culture, it feeds this idolatry of you are important based on what you bring to the table. That's a lie. We're important because Jesus says we're important. We're important because of what he brings to the table. We want to make much of him. And again, if you look through those gifts, it's the I speak with, I do this, my goal, my ambition. We need our ambition rescued. Ambition isn't a bad thing, but when it's ambition to make yourself known, to stand out, to be set apart, Jesus already looks at us and he says, I set you apart. Walk in it. You are set apart. You don't have to earn that. I set you apart with my love. I give you my gifts so that you can express love to one another. Now, walk in that. Use your gifts to build one another up. That's a phrase that we use in our house all the time. Are your words loving and building up, or are your words tearing people down? And sometimes daddy has to repent of that because I get irritable, I get resentful, I get envious, I want quiet when there's no quiet. So I've got a lot of repenting to do. I need Jesus just as much as I say everybody else does. Most of the descriptions of what love isn't involve being valued by accomplishment. What do we gain? What do we become? What do we have? And Paul says, no. That's not the way to measure it. One of the greatest lessons I've learned comes from our financial advisors. They're our financial advisors for the church. They are mine personally, Pastor Justin's personally. They say this: wealth is not measured by how much you possess, but by how much you can give away. That's gospel, isn't it? It's not how much I can accomplish, but how much I can build other people up. That's love. And Jesus and Paul are saying, that's what I want you to do. So don't get so caught up in your own gifting that you're using it to make a name for yourself. Use it to build up others, not so much to build up yourself. Let me pray for us. Spirit of the living God, we're asking you to have mercy on our love-lacking souls. We're asking you to point us to Jesus, who is love embodied. We're asking Jesus to remove the selfish ambition we're prone to give life to our hearts so that we love. When accomplishment defines us, when making a point defines us, when competency defines us, we will always be left empty. When love defines us, we will have our hearts satisfied to the full. So move in among and through us. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.